This is One-on-One with Mark Monteith on 1070 The Fan. Brought to you by Georgetown Market, Indy's family-owned natural food store since 1973. Movie Time Video Productions, they make your memories last forever.
He, more than anyone, was responsible for the Pacers' early success in the ABA. A native of Michigan City who attended Notre Dame, he had a fateful meeting in the Marine Corps that would determine the early direction of the Pacers when the ABA was formed in 1967. After working for the Baltimore and Cincinnati franchises in the NBA, he was hired as the Pacers' first general manager because of his military connections with one of the local founders. If not for him, the Pacers would never have signed future All-Stars and playoff MVPs Freddie Lewis or Roger Brown. If not for him, they wouldn't have been able to put on the league's first All-Star game. And if not for him, they might not have hired Slick Leonard as the team's second coach. He only worked two seasons for the Pacers, but he set them in motion toward three ABA titles. His Marine background served him well because he ran a disciplined front office and worked like crazy. He's had a widely varied career since then, working for other ABA and NBA teams, and now works out of Atlanta. But his legacy will always be intact in Indianapolis. I'm Mark Monteith, and I'm going one-on-one with Mike Storin. Well, today on One-on-One, we are going to speak with the original general manager of the Indiana Pacers, Mike Storin. This man got the franchise off to a great start back in 1967 when the franchise was formed, and has had a fascinating career in professional basketball and professional sports beyond that. So, Mike, I appreciate your time. I want to talk about your childhood growing up in Indiana. You're from Michigan City, right?
Yes, up right at the tip of Lake Michigan.
Another region guy.
That's right.
And I know, like all region people, you're proud of that.
Well, Northern Indiana, always believed that it was the best that Indiana high school sports had to offer. But I would suggest that the records might indicate that's not actually the case.
But you can claim it anyway, because people
right.
won't
we
check
never
their
let
records.
Facts. In sports, we never let facts get in the way of what we say.
That's right. Well, what was your athletic background growing up there? What sports did you participate in?
I was a football player, primarily. Also ran track, and the question was, did I run track by a stopwatch or by a calendar?
Not the fastest guy, huh?
Not the fastest guy,
okay.
That's right.
Were you much of a basketball fan, or did you play the game? Because that's certainly where you made your mark.
Actually, I grew up as a fan, although I went to the public high school in Michigan City, and we actually had very good basketball teams. And when I was a senior and the basketball season started before football ended, they held a space, and then we had a new coach, and after I'd been there a few weeks, he said, you know, you're really a nice young man, and we love having you on the basketball team. The problem is you aren't any good.
That's always a problem if you're not any good.
Right. And he said, I'd really like to bring up a really good sophomore who could provide something to our basketball team. So I gave up my position gladly, but not without obtaining. The high school had at halftime of basketball games, they had two sweepers who would, quote, sweep the basketball court at halftime, for which we received, each received $5. And so I turned in my basketball uniform for a sweeper's jacket and $5 a home game.
So you swept the floor at halftime of games.
Swept the floor.
Everybody finds a way to contribute. You went on to, did you go to Notre Dame?
Yes.
Yeah.
I went to Notre Dame, where I thought I was a very good football player, but the reality was the coaching staff didn't think I was nearly as good as I thought I was.
And from Notre Dame, you go to the Marine Corps.
And from when I graduated from Notre Dame, went into Marine Corps OCS. And then spent 5 years in the Marine Corps.
Yes, and at the Marine Corps, you made what turned out to be a fateful connection with a man named Dick Tinkham?
Yes, Dick is a practicing attorney in Indianapolis. outstanding attorney and a lifelong friend. And interestingly, Dick is also from Northern Indiana and played basketball and ran track at Hammond High, the purple and white of Hammond High School, and Michigan City in basketball always went to the Hammond Regional, and almost on schedule would play Hammond High in the afternoon of the regional finals and then lose, and the Hammond High would go on and win the regional and then go to semi-state at Lafayette.
Tell me the story. I mean, you've told me before, but I want our listeners to hear it, of your first meeting with Dick Tinkham.
Well, we quote, weren't formally introduced, and it was in the fall, and I was in Officer's Candidate School with the Marine Corps at Quantico, Virginia, and in the first several weeks of that exercise, the goal of the Marine Corps sergeants was, of course, to find out who had leadership potential and who they might discover had weaknesses that they should attack. Of course, one of the things they didn't like was anyone that had any type of argumentative nature to them or any independence, although they at later time valued leadership and independence. In the initial stages of, quote, tearing everybody down, they didn't care for anybody that had anything than a response that was other than yes, sir. And I remember very vividly on I think it was the first Saturday morning of the first week, we were undergoing an inspection, which, of course, was totally unsatisfactory to our drill sergeants. And near the conclusion of our receiving our morning rebuttal and information that we, of course, would not be allowed any leave for the weekend, the lieutenant in charge of our platoon came into the squad bay, and we were all standing at attention looking straight ahead, but introduced to the sergeant a new candidate that had arrived a week later because he was excused from the first week to take the Indiana bar exam. He was a lawyer, and it was, of course, candidate Tinkham. When he was taught immediately how to stand at attention and to answer questions appropriately, one of the questions that Sergeant Ochinkowski said, "So you're a lawyer?" And he said, "Yes, sir." And he said, "And so if you're a lawyer, you know the United States Constitution, is that correct?" And he said, "Yes, sir." And he said, "Well, could you repeat that document, that Constitution thing to me? Could you repeat that to me word for word?" And Tinkham's response was, "Would you like it forwards or backwards?" And what happened at that moment, I had been somewhat the center of attention for being a wise guy in the first week. From that moment forward, I knew that the entire focus of the drill sergeants would shift from me to candidate Tinkham.
He took the heat off of you.
That's exactly right. And I would suggest that from that moment forward, we became great friends.
Yes, and that friendship would later pay off because your relationship with Dick Tinkham would be the reason you became the Pacers' first general manager, and we'll get into that later. Well, before the Pacers, however, you get a job in professional basketball with the Chicago Zephyrs. How do you get from the Marine Corps to the NBA?
A circuitous route. The reality was I was getting out of the Marine Corps, and I was stationed in defending our country in Chicago, Illinois, and I was in charge of a Marine Corps reserve component in Chicago. Actually, it was the 13th largest unit in the country. But it was, I read in the paper, the Chicago Tribune, that the then Chicago Zephyrs had sold 600 season tickets and were concerned about staying in Chicago. So I made an appointment with the then owner of the Zephyrs, a gentleman by the name of David Traeger. David owned an insurance company, and I couldn't get an appointment. Finally, I called and said, "This is Captain Mike Storni, the United States Marine Corps, and I have a private matter to discuss with Mr. Traeger." And so they, of course, didn't know what it was. So I arrived in my dress blues and told him that I would guarantee him the sale of 600 new season tickets if he'd hire me for his basketball team. He agreed to do that as long as his, quote, acting general manager would agree, who turned out to be the sports editor of the Minneapolis Tribune, a guy named Sid Hartman. And interestingly, Sid still is in Minneapolis, and his son has a radio show there.
And Sid still writes for the newspaper there.
And Sid still writes for, he's got to be 110 years old.
I believe he's in his 90s, yeah.
Close. And at any rate, Sid was, in fact, the guy that was running the Chicago pro basketball team very quietly behind the scenes. Anyway, they agreed to hire me, and I'm sitting at my breakfast table about 2 weeks ready to get out of the service and go to work, and I read where the team has gone to Baltimore. I called him up, and I said to Mr. Traeger, I'm supposed to come to work in 2 weeks, and the team's in Baltimore. He said, oh, yeah, I forgot to tell you that. he said, you know, and you don't have a job. I said, you know what? So what? I said, your team has 10 black basketball players. Your coach is an atheist. The team is owned by 10 Jewish businessmen. And I said, you're headed into the seat of Catholicism in Baltimore, Maryland. And I said, you need to hire a good Catholic boy for your basketball team. And strangely enough, on no good foundation, he said, you know, I think you're right. and I went to Baltimore as a promotion director for what then was the Baltimore Bullets and then subsequently became the Washington Bullets and now is the Washington's
Wizards.
That's right. And Traeger ended up selling the team in Baltimore to three gentlemen, one of whom was Abe Polan, who I just believe died just this year. And Abe became the longest standing owner of an NBA franchise.
Storin uses all his wiles to land a job in the NBA, then takes advantage of a military connection to land a job with the Pacers when they're formed in 1967. And then some other connections help him build a championship team, as we'll learn when One-on-One continues. Welcome back to One-on-One. I'm Mark Monteith. This week's guest is the original GM of the Indiana Pacers, Mike Storin. We learned in the last segment how Storin got into the NBA. Now let's find out how he winds up with the Pacers and puts together the nucleus of a championship team.
How do you promote a basketball team in Baltimore in the early 1960s? I mean, what did you do?
Started at the top floor of the tallest building and knocked on the door of every office and probably in the city that time and sold season tickets. And then we instituted a program where high school teams came in and played prelim games and built a very big preliminary game program and built what in those days was a pretty successful franchise.
And you have another fateful connection in Baltimore by the name of Slick Leonard.
Slick was the coach, and he subsequently was replaced by a series of coaches. But that's where I did first really meet and get to know Bob and his wife Nancy.
Yes, and then from Baltimore you go to the Cincinnati Royals.
Yes, the team in Baltimore got sold. When that time came, when they made that sale, I had heard from the Cincinnati Royals and went up there as a business manager and assistant general manager. Of course, the mainstay of that basketball team was a fellow by the name of Oscar Robertson.
Yes.
Oscar was very busy in those days recording triple-doubles that nobody knew and understood
And nobody talked about it back then, did they?
Right. All of a sudden, is Oscar's really good.
Yes. Yes, he was. The foundation of the franchise, certainly. But the ABA is formed in 1967, and you had been in Cincinnati, what, just a couple years at that point?
I had been there about 2 years, and Dick Tinkham called me and said that he was and a couple of friends were looking to bring a team to Indianapolis. I said, well, you know, if there's a league forming, whatever you do, don't give those guys any money to join a new league. And to make a long story short, he invited me, we went to initial meetings, and the ABA formed.
Very loosely formed, but it formed. How was it a difficult decision for you to leave the Royals, which is at least in an established league, to go to this new league that most people don't think will survive a year?
Well, a couple of things came to play. One, I was young and to an extent naive, and so I assumed that the league could be successful and assumed that we could be successful. And it was an opportunity to, for lack of better language, be in charge. In Cincinnati, I was the assistant general manager and had very little authority in the actual running of the franchise. So this was a great opportunity, and it was lots of other things. It was coming home, quote, to Indiana. It was working with people who were contemporaries and personal and business friends. And, you know, even I understood that Indiana was a great basketball state and that Indianapolis had the potential to be a great success.
Yeah, there was certainly a market for the ABA because a lot of great players weren't even able to get into the NBA, and certainly Indianapolis was starved for something. It had been 14 years since it had had a professional basketball franchise, since the Olympians had folded in 1953. So really, the city was ready to pounce on something, so the timing was great. And you used another connection to help form the roster. You had a backup point guard on the Royals named Freddie Lewis.
Yep, Freddie was a good player, and, you know, his problem, like many players, particularly in those days, you know, there weren't many teams, and B, there weren't many roster spots, and if you were a rookie, the chance for you to break in was very limited, and so Freddie was, quite frankly, was stuck behind Adrian Smith and Oscar Robertson.
Not much of a future there.
If you think you're a good ball handler and want to run an offense, there's not much future behind Oscar Robertson to do that. Freddie wanted more than anything else a chance to play. And quite frankly, you know, in those days, the money that the players were making was not so significant that a backup player like Freddie wouldn't be interested in coming to Indiana.
Yeah, I talked with him recently for this series, and he said that he remembers going to your house and talking, and he was ready to jump on it right away. He didn't have much hesitation about taking a chance with this new league because he wanted a chance to play.
Yeah, awfully nice guy, and a very good player.
Yeah.
I mean, he was very unselfish, which was, you know, sort of an earmark of the Pacer teams. A major part of his motivation is he wanted to prove that he, in fact, could play, and the reality was he could.
Yes, yes. There were a lot of fateful things that came together to get this franchise going. I know you guys made an effort to talk to Oscar Robertson about being a player coach. Did you ever feel like you had a chance to actually get him to the Pacers?
If you were in the state of Indiana at that time and you were going to participate in professional basketball, you had to talk to Oscar Robertson. You wanted to talk to Oscar Robertson. I don't mean it's not you had to talk to. You couldn't be serious about your business and not do that. But you have to remember that Oscar Robertson was the first player to sign a $100,000 contract. And I have to tell you, the ownership of the Royals, who was a family by name of Jacobs that were in the concession business, and they had an attorney in Cincinnati who was de facto running the team. After they signed the contract, they thought they'd absolutely lost their minds. But, you know, Oscar was, you know, the premier, one if not the premier player in the country, and there was no legitimate business reason for him to say, I want to go to a new league and even the lure of, quote, ownership didn't make great sense to him. So Oscar in those days had an advisor whose name escapes me now, a guy in the construction company in Cincinnati, a very sound businessman who could look through and say, you know, Oscar, why would you do this? What do you have to gain? And there, you know, there really wasn't that much. So
yeah.
Although we made a run at him, thanks to mostly in part Bob Collins.
Sports editor of the Star.
Sports editor of the Star, who had known Oscar in his high school and collegiate days and had stayed in contact with him. So Bob was very helpful in opening that door and getting us that audience, but it wasn't, it just didn't make sense for him to jump at that time.
Yeah, too big of a risk. But he turned you on to another player.
Well, he'd done that earlier. When I was in Cincinnati and when I said I was going to the Pacers, Oscar said, Mike, you know, the first thing you need to do is go to Dayton and talk to Roger Brown. I wasn't so dumb that I didn't listen to him. And the morning that I signed my agreement to run the Pacers, I signed an agreement with a banker who was one of the original investors up in Lebanon, Indiana. His name was Joe Bannon.
Mm-hmm.
And I literally signed an agreement with Joe Bannon in Lebanon and drove from Lebanon to Dayton, Ohio, and hooked up with Roger for the first time.
And at this time, Roger is working in a factory, a General Motors factory. He had been a great high school player out of New York. He was supposed to go to Dayton to play college basketball, but had been banned because of a very loose association with a gambler in New York. He got caught up in a kind of a mania over point shaving and so forth, and he really was a victim of this because he really, from what everybody has at least told me, didn't have much of an association with this guy, just knew him, and he's banned from playing college basketball and banned from the NBA. So this guy is working in a factory in Dayton and playing, you know, pickup games with people like Oscar Robertson, so therefore they know about him. So you just kind of took Oscar's word for it that this guy is somebody you wanted to sign.
At least in my mind, if Oscar said he could play, there wasn't any further review that was needed.
I've gone back and looked at all the newspaper articles during this time when the Pacers were being formed, and there was never an announcement that the Pacers had signed this guy, Roger Brown. It gave me the impression that because of his, you know, background and this supposed link with gamblers, that you didn't really want that out, that you wanted to kind of keep that hush-hush. He just kind of arrived on the scene and suddenly appeared on the roster on opening night.
Well, it was I would say that that's true, but if you probably don't remember, but on the opening night, the Indianapolis News, the sports editor was Wayne Fusen.
Mm-hmm.
They had a front page picture of Ron Bonham and Roger Brown. Color picture, which in those days was very unusual.
Absolutely.
And along with the secretary that we had by the name of Sandra Wheatley. So it was known that Roger was going to be a real player.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But, you're correct in saying that there was no fanfare made over signing him originally.
Yeah, because, you know, you send out announcements about every guy you sign, you know, even guys who didn't come close to making the team, but there was never anything about Roger Brown. It just seemed like you were really concerned about image from the very beginning. We're talking about these players because Roger and Freddie both are starters on all three ABA championship teams. Roger's the MVP of the 1970 finals. Freddie's the MVP of the 72 finals. And here's two players that you just kind of come across. I mean, they're right there for you at the very beginning. A lot of fateful moments go into getting this thing rolling, including Slick Leonard, who you've met in Baltimore, is up living in Kokomo selling class rings, and you're able to hire him as the coach in the second season.
Yes.
So this whole thing just kind of came together in a lot of fateful ways.
The Pacers choose their colors and a nickname, and Storen begins piecing together a championship franchise from the back room of a jewelry store when One-on-One continues. Welcome back to One-on-One. I'm Mark Monteith, and I'm talking today with Mike Storen, the original general manager of the Indiana Pacers. Storen had his hand in nearly every decision made when the Pacers were getting off the ground, from their colors to their nickname to the logo. Let's look at the formative years of the franchise and how the Pacers quickly became the class of the ABA.
You were involved in everything about the Pacers. Is it true that their colors are blue and gold because those are the state colors?
Yep. We got the, it was the Indiana Pacers, and a lot of people have since said it was because they were Notre Dame's colors, but the fact was the actual colors and the color codes were both taken from the blue and the yellow, or gold, it was really yellow, were taken from the Indiana state flag.
Right. And why the nickname Pacers?
We played originally, as you know, at the fairgrounds, and the fairgrounds in the summer featured the Pacer horse racing. And we ended up, our first publicity director was a guy named Bill Marvel, who worked with the Andretti group, what was the group that involved Mario Andretti and as an original race driver. And so we got involved with, quote, the racetrack and the pace car. So we had the pace car involved with the 500, the racehorses, the Pacers from the state fairgrounds. And then we wanted to, quote, to set the pace for the new league. And it was a name that was unique. There were no, quote, other Pacers in any other sports leagues throughout the United States. So that's why I settled on the name the Pacers.
How many full-time employees did you have at the beginning?
Let's see. We had a publicity director, Bill Marvel. We had a trainer, a unique combination of a trainer and business manager, a guy by the name of Bernie LaRue, who came to us. And he'd been a trainer with the Chicago Bears. He was full-time. We had a group salesman by the name of Chuck Finkbeiner. Let's see, that gave us three. We had a full-time ticket manager, which was very unusual in those days. The good news was he was busy.
Mel Brown, right?
And then we had two secretaries, one of which was Sandra Wheatley, and we had a second secretary. So we had for a professional basketball team, was a fairly big staff.
Half a dozen people. About five or six people are running this thing, getting it off the ground. And people have told me that, you know, your military background kind of came into play here. You ran a very highly disciplined organization and demanded a lot of effort from everybody.
Well, that would depend on, of course, who you talk to. The unique thing was that we had a very strong ownership group that understood the organization. So an unhappy employer or an unhappy player or an unhappy front office person or somebody with a complaint really couldn't get to anybody without going through me. And so that made, we were able to get a lot done with a minimal amount of effort.
Yeah, it was an efficient organization. There was no dead weight or no wasted time or space. I know that. Your offices are on 38th Street, not too far from the Coliseum.
Well, it was pretty interesting. We leased it was a jewelry store. And when we had signed the original lease, we couldn't get in for like 2 months. And so for the first 2 months, I operated out of the back room of this jewelry store. So that's why when you hear Nedelecki tell a story or Freddie Lewis or Roger, they were more likely to say, well, when I was at Storen's house.
Yeah, a lot of things happening at your house, right?
Because we didn't quite look right to bring him into the back room of a jewelry store to talk about their contract.
And you had players even out there selling tickets, right? Because I know I've seen some of the financials. Nedelecki got a couple $100 commission that first year off the tickets he was able to sell.
I don't really remember that. I would guess that's probably true, but I would suggest that it's never, Nedelecki contributed, 20 points a game, and I would say that did more for our season tickets than the girls that he tried to sell tickets to at midnight.
I know what you mean. So you got Freddie Lewis off the Royals. You bring in Roger Brown out of a factory in Dayton. You draft Nedeljkovic in the second round. That first year, you make the playoffs, but things don't finish the way you hope. Eliminated first round. Second year, you get off to a slow start, so you grab Slick Leonard out of Kokomo. And he even keeps his job selling class rings because he's not sure about this new league. So you've got Roger, Freddie, Neto, and Slick. And you have acquired the Rookie of the Year in the first year of the ABA, a guy by the name of Mel Daniels, and one of the great heists of all time as a trade. Traded two players who weren't playing anyway in Ron Kozlicki and Jimmy Dawson, and then somebody came up with, what, $100,000 to get Mel out of Minneapolis?
Yep. Yeah.
Today you're not going to get a Rookie of the Year for anything equivalent of $100,000 in a trade, but because they were struggling financially, you're able to get Mel. So right there, you got a nucleus of what becomes a three-time championship team.
Yeah, well, Mel was a fiercely, still is probably, fiercely competitive person. And he, you know, at 6'9", I'd say wasn't that big, but, you know, he was solid. He was, you know, like 6'9", 225, and very solid. But, you know, the thing about Mel was that, you know, he gave you emotionally everything he had on both ends of the floor, every minute he was on the floor.
Yeah.
He became not only, he was really a emotional leader as a result of the way he played and just simply dominated the league. And in spite of the fact that, you know, subsequently Artis Gilmore came in the league and Spencer Haywood came in the league and Dan Issel came in the league, Mel really was the guy, although unheralded, was really the ABA prototype center for its first 5 years.
Yeah, absolutely. Two-time league most valuable player, a perennial all-star, that kind of thing. And speaking of Mel, we should bring up one of your greater accomplishments with the Pacers was that you put on the first ABA all-star game. This is in December of 1967, I believe, or maybe it's January of 68, the first year of the league. The league wants to have an all-star game. Really, your franchise is the only one capable of putting it on. And you get Butler Fieldhouse finally to agree to use their facility and put together the first All-Star game. That had to be a million headaches for you.
Yes, I had run the NBA All-Star game in Cincinnati 2 years earlier, and so I should have known better. But we did hold it at the Hinkle, and the morning of the game, that night, the city had about 7 inches of snow, and we woke up that morning with, you know, and I thought, oh, this is going to be, what a disaster. Turned out it was a great game, and Larry Brown was the most valuable player.
Mel should have gotten it, but they took the voting about 5 minutes before the game ended, and Larry Brown got it.
That's right. Yeah. That's exactly right. Everybody booed. Everybody booed Larry Brown. I mean, it wasn't his fault.
Now, one thing you were very adept at was, if necessary, giving away tickets to fill the house, because that first All-Star game was nationally televised, and, you know, you wanted to put on a good show. You wanted it to look good on national TV, so you managed to give away a lot of tickets to get people out there in bad weather.
There's a little bit of an art to giving away tickets. and I learned that art very early.
What, you go to children's groups or police office, you know, police groups, that kind of thing? You kind of do it by groups, don't you?
Well, we did lots of group sales. Yeah. We did that, you know, had lots of group sales. And, you know, you have to remember, we really had both newspapers, although competitors with each other. Both the sports editors at the time, Wayne Fusen and Bob Collins, both wanted to see the team succeed, as did the radio and television members. So we really, a lot of stars were aligned that, you know, allowed us to be successful. So, you know, we got a high acceptance level and got, you know, the kinds of support that, you know, so many teams and franchises never were able to enjoy. Generally, if there's two papers there, one would be supportive and one would be maybe even deliberately take the opposite view. But we had both papers that were supportive, and the electronic media was supportive, and quite frankly, the people that everybody that was involved with the 500 was supportive. You know, we had a lot of good support, you know, which started with the people that owned the team because their goal was they wanted to create and have an event for the community. And that was not lip service, but that was all real.
Storen leaves the Pacers for the Kentucky Colonels and then watches his former team beat his current team for the ABA championship when one-on-one continues. Welcome back to One-on-One. I'm Mark Monteith. Do not forget that you can catch all the episodes of this series on our website at 1070thefan.com. Simply scroll to the bottom of the homepage, click on the One-on-One window, and you'll have access to all the episodes of this series. Now, let's get back to today's guest, Mike Storen, who just 2 years into his job with the Pacers gets an offer he can't refuse.
The Pacers, you know, we mentioned they get to the playoffs the first year. The second year when Slick comes in early in the season, things start to take off. It's clear that they got a real nucleus here and a team that's going to take off. But in April of 69, you take a job with the Kentucky Colonels. How did that come about?
The original owners of Kentucky when the league formed was a couple by the name of Mamie and Joe Gregory. Mamie Gregory had inherited a substantial amount of money, and her husband was a professional dog judge. And they supported the team, and then they sold it to a group of young entrepreneurs, John Y. Brown, who founded Kentucky Fried Chicken, and Wendell Cherry, and David Jones, who founded Humana Corporation. So there were four young entrepreneur, wealthy guys who bought the Kentucky team. And they contacted me and offered me an ownership position and control the team. And it was a awfully good business opportunity for me. So I went to Kentucky. The most interesting part of going to Kentucky was before I left Indiana, I sent a letter to dear general manager, Kentucky Colonels. We'd like to play 8 exhibition games with you and get on a bus and barnstorm between Indiana and Kentucky for exhibition season. And then when I got to Kentucky, I said, "Dear General Manager of Indiana, we accept your offer."
That's classic. I love that story. Took care of both ends.
That's right. It worked out great.
Yeah, and indeed, the Pacers and Colonels did play, about 8 exhibition games against one another that year, if I remember correctly.
We 6 did, or 8. And then, as you might imagine, both Dick Tinkham and I were very active, you know, in roles with the league. And when I went to Kentucky and we figured out that we could very easily have the two best teams in the league, we got the league realigned, interestingly, so that Indiana played in the Western Division.
That's right.
And Kentucky played in the Eastern Division. And we were able to play each other for the championship.
Right. In 1973, the Pacers and Colonels played for the championship, and you had had a major role in forming both of those teams, so you must have felt a lot of pride about that.
Well, it was actually, I'd hired almost all the players on both teams and had hired the almost every man in the front office of both teams. That included, you know, the radio personalities and the people that were doing the telecasts and so forth. So it was awfully exciting. The bad news was the Pacers, the seventh game was in Kentucky, was at Freedom Hall. Good news is it was sold out. Bad news was Indiana won, and although would have preferred to have had Kentucky win, it was not a moment that I wasn't able to enjoy emotionally.
Yeah, the Pacers did win Game 7. George McGinnis was the MVP of that series. Yep. And it was a great series because teams kept winning on each other's home court. The home court advantage didn't mean much in that series.
I've always said, still do occasion today, Bob Leonard may be the best seventh game coach in basketball. So many coaches always want to assume, quote, that the team's going to come out fired up and ready to go, and I, the coach, really don't have to do anything. This is the seventh game. Well, I'm here to tell you, Bob Leonard never left it up to the players to decide if they were going to be ready to play a seventh game.
That's right. Well, do you ever look back and wonder how it would have turned out if you had just remained the GM of the Pacers?
Well, there's no benefit to that. So who knows? I think the great thing is the Simon family at one stage was able to step in and stabilize the franchise financially.
Yeah, save it.
And so it's always great to see, hear, watch the Pacers. It's a different economic atmosphere, but you know, you still got to put the ball in the basket.
Yeah. Do you follow the franchise closely now? I mean, do you still feel a connection?
Yes, certainly, but I'm not officially connected with them in any way.
Yeah.
Since Donnie Welsh has left, I really haven't been in contact with them at all. But great franchise, great people, and, of course, a great city.
Yeah. Did you know Donnie pretty well?
Not real well. He was always extremely gracious. Anytime I was in Indianapolis, he was always quick to want to have a lunch or a dinner or make sure that I came to the games. And a consummate professional and just an awfully nice guy on top of it.
Yeah, I got an off-the-wall question I've asked everyone. This may not really apply to you, but when you dream, when you're sleeping at night and you're dreaming, do you ever have dreams that you're running a professional basketball franchise again or something like that? I often ask former players, do they dream of playing again? And they usually do have those dreams. Do you have dreams that you're, you know, running the Pacers or another NBA?
Do I have any nightmares?
Yeah, it could be nightmares too. It could work either way, I realize.
Oh, no, that sort of falls into a category of regrets, and I really don't have any regrets.
Okay, no regrets? Because you could play that game and say, if I had just stayed with the Pacers, I could have been their GM for who knows how long and might have even done it throughout the 1980s and 90s or whatever. I mean,
history would tell us that in the course of those years, we probably would have had a disagreement with somebody.
Yeah. A lot of ownership changes. It would have been difficult to stay on the same page with all those different ownership groups, I'm sure.
I would suggest that's absolutely right.
So you stayed one step ahead of the posse, didn't you? You always kept moving.
You can't hit a moving target.
Well, hey, Mike, I appreciate all your time. This
has
been great.
Well, it's my pleasure, and it was a great time, and it's very exciting to see the city continue to grow, and I really believe the Pacers in those days gave the city a reason to say, yes, we can. And when you look at what people like Bill McGowan and so many others have done, building Indianapolis into the amateur sports capital of the world and into bringing in, you know, the Super Bowl champion and accomplishing the things that they have, I would like to believe in the middle of the night the accomplishment of the Pacers gave everybody a confidence level that said we can reach whatever dreams it are that we set for ourselves.
One-on-One returns in a moment.
Back on One-on-One, Mark Monteith here. Thanks to Mike Storn for passing along his story.
There's no doubt the Pacers benefited from an incredible amount of positive fate when they were formed, not the least of which was Storen's connection with one of the founders, Dick Tinkham. After guiding the Pacers and the Kentucky Colonels, Storen went on to become the ABA commissioner, and then the owner of the Memphis franchise. The idea was that a merger with the NBA might be coming soon, and he wanted to be holding a franchise. That didn't work out, and neither did some of his later jobs. But he's kept going. He was the GM of the Atlanta Hawks until Ted Turner bought the team, and he's owned minor league basketball and arena football teams. He's now working in Atlanta, where he's involved in several sports and real estate projects. He also happens to be the father of television sportscaster Hannah Storm, who obviously lived a couple of years of her early life in Indianapolis while Dad worked for the Pacers. No doubt about it, Storen did things his way, and his way was great for the Indiana Pacers. That's it for now. If you want to reach me, my email address is mark@1070thefan.com, and I'm also on Facebook. And I'll be back next week with another spine-tingling episode of One-on-One, right here on 1070 The Fan.